But, in fact, the radio that I'm on right now, I bought from Dick, and it's doing a good job still. Thank you very much. Bye-bye now.
Well, thank you very much, Gene. Anyone else, please, if you would like to say something on this terrible night of ours, remembering some story about Dick or of you listening to the Technical Net or what have you, whatever your heart feels the need to share, please. I will drop the mic for a minute or two and give everything the opportunity to reset, and please give me your call sign and your first name.
N2RQ.
Yes, Lou.
I tuned in late, so I didn't hear the official notice, but I'm going through some of my old files. One thing that I remember, and I still have the remnants, I bought a generator, thanks to Dick, after Hurricane Gloria. Still a functioning machine in my garage. And he arranged for a collective buy of a huge number of generators in that year. And I know a few people on here who also bought them. Back to you, Roy.
Oh, thank you, Lou. Yeah, I remember, I don't think I was around for that episode, but I remember Dick, telling the story of how he got together with a bunch of people and got a good deal on a discount for a group purchase. And, he was telling stories of how at one point the generators were a hot topic, and he had someone who had a lot of expertise in generators, and they gave a little presentation on the subject, and yeah, it's, one of the things that the Technical Net had were these interesting little side discussions of generators, which is important in amateur radio, but, I mean, other things would pop up as topics on the Technical Net and be discussed for an hour or more. And that was part of the charm of the Technical Net. It wasn't a kind of a freeze-dried recitation of, only a few kind of wandered about a bit, which I thought was endearing of it. So thank you very much, Lou, for your comments. Anyone else want to say something tonight, so please feel free. I will drop the mic and have everything reset, and if you want to, you just give me your call sign and your first name.
K2KND.
Yes, Richie.
Well, don't need to tell you how emotional this is, and particularly that this is April, and it's just a year ago in April that Eric passed away. First of all, Dick made my job as president of Limark very easy, because Limark had the TechNet, and that immediately elevated me to a certain level as the president of the club that had the TechNet, and Dick Needle after some 38 years. But it was interesting with Dick because, as everyone knew, he was incredibly bright. And sometimes when you first got to know him, he was kind of sizing you up to know, who you were and what kind of conversations he could have with you. And I tell you, in the beginning, it was kind of like a little distance there. Then he talked about that. Now nothing that I could do that was wrong anymore. Boy, I had gone to Pratt, and he had gone to Pratt, and we talked about it, and a downtown campus in Brooklyn and all those things. But there was a big difference between us, and that was that he had gone to Pratt to learn everything that there was about RF engineering, and I went there to learn how to play pinochle. And I would remind him of that from time to time, and we'd have a good laugh about it. I would call him up often, ask him a technical question that I felt might be silly if I asked on the technet, and we would sit and talk for a long period of time, and he would explain things to me, and very thorough explanations, no matter how much time it took. And I have to say that I might have been one of the last to speak to him on the telephone. I spoke to him about 4 weeks ago. And I do want to say that people have asked me how he was doing, and I've always said, you know, he had certain situations, and I just assured everyone that they were not life-threatening. And that's a point that I do want to make. His situations were not life-threatening, but I do believe that after speaking to Chris, he started to kind of go into depression. I think he missed the TechNet. I think his physical conditions were getting the best of him. And just something to kind of remember. Stay in touch with people. But we'll certainly miss him. Roy, I have to tell you, doing a great job in filling in for him. We all learn from him, and we're certainly going to miss him. There are no funeral arrangements at this time. As most of you know, under the circumstances, it won't, not an opportunity for that. But I did speak to Chris, and I think what will happen is something as was done for Eric. They'll deal with whatever they have to do now, and sometime in the near future, there'll be a memorial celebration for Dick, wherever it'll be, and we'll keep you informed of that. So, back to Ned, this is K2K and me.
Thank you very much, Richie. John, KC2SHO, is in the chat room. He's listening via IRLP. He can't seem to get his signal across. I'll ask everyone to remain quiet for a minute or two and see if maybe he can get through. Maybe it's a timeout issue. Otherwise, I'd suggest maybe he look into EchoLink, but I'll drop the microphone for a minute or two and give John KC2SHO a chance to get in his words. No, unfortunately not. He tried and it didn't come across. Again, John, I'm sure you're hearing me. If you want to try something, you're going to try rebooting everything. Also, you can try EchoLink. I know EchoLink is not probably the perfect solution, but, you know, it's an option, so keep it in mind. So hopefully we'll hear from John KC2SHO soon. Again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy. I am the net control operator for this episode of the Limark Technical Net, an institution in the metropolitan area. So when I first got my license, and I asked people, you know, who is there out there to ask any questions or find out anything, they all pretty much said the same thing: listen to the technical net. And I did, and I never turned back from it. It was a solid scheduled thing every Sunday night from 8 o'clock on. I would listen almost religiously and learned a lot of great things from Dick, and was very happy when we were able to have conversations together. They were some of the most interesting conversations that I've had. So anyway, if anyone out there would like to say something tonight, please Just give me your call sign and your first name, and you can say something tonight. KD2OG, be mobile for a question. Okay, Craig. Roy, how you doing? First thing is first, can the question be about anything? Well, I wouldn't quite say anything. You can ask any question of a scientific nature. You should try and stay away from religion and politics and such. But all things being equal, hopefully your question will be acceptable. All right, with time permitting, as I'm getting closer to home, I took a little physical for a job coming up, and one part of it was the peripheral vision test, and something that I've never been tested on. You look straight ahead without turning your eyes, and you try to pinpoint flashing lights. Now, unfortunately, I didn't make it, so I had to see an ophthalmologist, but do you think maybe that I probably didn't understand it because I was cleared, because it was required for a position that I was going for, or probably I wasn't looking straight ahead at what I was doing? Well, Craig, it's difficult for me to tell you exactly why you failed it the first time and you passed it the second time. It is two different people. They might not be as strict, or you might not have followed the exact direction. It's supposed to indicate whether you can recognize flashes in the peripheral of your vision. Most of our vision is a very narrow cone in an object called a fovea. It's a very dense set of retinal light detecting cells. And that's where we do reading and all kinds of highly detailed vision. As you go beyond the fovea, the density of retinal cells diminish, so that in your periphery, you can just vaguely make things out. Another weird thing about the retina is that in vertebrates, the wiring, you would sort of think that if you thought of a retina as a visual chip, like a camera, and you would think the wiring is behind it. But actually, the wiring in all vertebrate types is the other way around. So the wiring kind of comes out the front, and then it has to perforate through the retina in order to get to the outside of the eyeball. So we all actually have a blind spot where that happens. Our brain processes things and gets rid of the blind spot. It gets rid of the very low resolution peripheral vision. We tend to think of our peripheral vision as better than it really is. So if he told you to look at a certain point and you didn't look at the certain point, then the peripheral signal you would have missed because it was even farther away than the person testing you was meant to test you for. So that's about of a gist of how vision works and peripheral vision tests are. Right, very good for the explanation. What I needed to do, this is for the railroad, just so you know. What they had me look at was a road, and I guess this tiny black dot in the center, and it was all, I guess, a light photo, and I couldn't really see where the lights were coming from. But at the ophthalmologist, they had me stare at a single dot, and then I was actually able to pick up the lights. Probably because the picture was different, unlike what I would normally see, that's probably why I didn't really see any flashing lights at all. But yeah, a 70-degree field of view is what's required for this position, because I need to see what's coming out of the corner of my eye if I need to clean stuff up or pick stuff up at track level. Yes, Craig, that's quite understandable. You have to understand that there are liability issues. If they gave you a job that was dangerous and something went terribly wrong and someone went back in the history books and said, did you check whether this guy had peripheral vision? And they said, what? Then they would get into trouble. So it's all, everyone kind of either covering their backside or being a good citizen, whichever tack you want to take as far as that goes. So it's understandable that they require a peripheral vision test, since you would be putting yourself and other people at risk if you couldn't see out of the corners of your eyes.
Yeah, but I got cleared, thankfully, so nothing seems wrong with my peripheral vision. Plus, I have to get retested every 3 years for it, actually, when I go back for the physical, so I was actually told of that, but hopefully I'll make it through this time. Thank you very much for your help. AC2GS, KD2OGB Mobile, back to net control.
Okay, Craig, I wish you luck. Yeah, peripheral vision usually needs to be repeatedly assessed because there are a lot of health issues can impact peripheral vision. If you develop glaucoma, that's an increased pressure in your eyeball, diabetes, retinal detachment, different kind of neurological abnormalities can produce worsening peripheral vision, so it's not a static quality. So it's understandable that they have some guidelines along the lines of once every 3 years that you have to be tested. But I wish you luck on your future endeavors, Craig.
Thank you very much. Carry on, KD2OGB Mobile.
Okay, once again, this is AC2GS, and this is the Limark Technical Net, and if anyone would like to question or make a comment or say a few words on this horrid night of ours, please feel free. Unfortunately, you know, I would love to have John, KC2SHO, say something because he wants to. Let's say I'll drop the mic for a minute or two and see maybe if John wants to try RLP again.
And WS2N, I have a message to pass along.
Okay, very good, Paul. Please pass the message along.
This is from Chris C. on the chat net. He wanted to pass along his message. He said, I'm shocked, really sad to hear. I've listened to Dick on the tech net on and off for 30 plus years via a scanner, and I've really enjoyed and learned a lot from listening. And then he also wrote, I'd like to thank Dick and his family for his service to the radio world, and especially for the TechNet and all that he has taught. My condolences to the family. Feel free to say over the air if anyone wants to pass it along, and I'm passing it along. Chris C. Doesn't have a license yet, but he wrote it. He promises to get one in honor of Dick. Back to you, Roy. WS2N.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Paul. I'm seeing his notes on chat room. His last, most recent entry is in response to the fact that you mentioned he doesn't have a license yet, and he says, but I promise to get one now to honor Dick. And, you know, if there's one thing that would make Dick smile, would be the idea of anything that he said or did leading to another amateur radio operator. The more the merrier, and he had the patience for every last one of us. So once again, this is AC2GS, and I just looked at the chat room, and John said not possible. He rebooted the same time last Johnny chat. He has dropped packets. Okay, so it's not gonna happen tonight that he's gonna get through IRLP. There's some problem at the connection. So if he would like to, I think Paul will pass on what he wants to say. If not, like I said before, Echo Link is available. But if anyone else out there has anything that they want to say or any questions they want to ask tonight, please feel free. Just give me your first name and your call sign.
And to extend, but I will wait. Maybe somebody has something to say before me.
Okay, how come I don't hear it at all?
Because we have a half duplex link, and Wesley came on.
Okay, so we'll all stay nice and quiet, and hopefully we'll hear it, right, Lou?
Yes.
KD2TRG, Bob from Stony Brook, New York.
Yes, Bob.
I'm new to the ham world, although I'm not new to RF. I've been in the RF business since 1978 when I was an ET in the Navy. And one of the things I was actually looking forward to was Dick's TechNet. I'm a member of the Brookhaven National Club out here on the island, and I've only had my license. I got my tech license, and I got my general license a week after that. I was going for my, but the coronavirus has kind of put the brakes on it right now for me. But I was looking forward to listening and hearing, because I've heard numerous things about Dick and his TechNet. And all I can say is technical information is very hard to come by these days. And a lot of guys take things for granted. And knowledge is definitely power, as Einstein. And people that are the... is just an amazing thing. And it will truly be missed. And I'm sure I will lose out on a few things, but I'm also sure that you will step into his shoes, Roy, and do a phenomenal job, and I'm looking forward to having some good QSOs and Q&As with you in the near future. KD2TRG, back to net.
Well, thanks a lot, Bob. I appreciate the kind words, and as I've mentioned before, there's something at least like 12 years worth of Dick's technical nets archived and available on amateurradio.tv. There's a whole column. You click on what year you want, and there's a long, long list of archived audio files, and you could either the early ones, Mike, KC1, KC2, NJI actually indexed the subjects. I think after a few years of that, he got a little fatigued, so he just put them up on index. But it is at least 12 years worth of Dick's fine material. And, you know, when you have nothing better to do, you know, everyone kind of goes to YouTube to see cute kittens and such. I would suggest you go to amateurradio.tv and pull off an episode of a technical net from the last 12 years and take a listen to it. It ages well.
And I will definitely make sure I do that. Especially in Dick's honor, I will make sure I get out there and see as much and learn as much as I can to keep him proud. KD2TRG, back to net.
Thank you very much, Bob. Wesley, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you if it is appropriate to go to any science questions. I was again moved by a comment of the person before me. And yes, Dr. Roy, I happen to know a few great people. It was Dick, then it was KC2WGB, John, and now it's you. And you're taking a job. And I do thank you for it. Thank you.
Well, thanks a lot, Wesley. And just being compared to people like Dick and John is a heck of a compliment. And I don't know if I deserve it, but I do appreciate your kind words.
And
10 WS2N, I have a message from John, KC2SHO.
Okay, very good, Paul. Please tell us John's message.
Okay, he said I started listening about 6 years ago. If I had to guess, Dick helped my understanding of RF, which helped my career. He will be missed dearly. I wish I could have met him. Rest in peace. We need to continue the TechNet in his honor. Very good. I remember, I think I remember when John moved out there, and I used to talk to Dick quite a bit about it before he left, but pretty sure it was him. But that was the message. Back to you, Ryan, WS1.
Okay, very good. I seem to recall when he first moved out there and he hooked up his IRLP and he told us the story of how he came from this area and he answered an ad on someone who has a good understanding of RF theory and got the job over there in Los Alamos and it sounds like a fascinating a place in many, many, many ways. It's filled with scientific revelations and very smart people and history. There's a lot of scientific history that went on in Los Alamos, and I'm glad that John is able to communicate with us. Most of TechNet through IRLP and share his thoughts with us. So I thank you very much, John, for your words, and I hope that soon we'll reestablish the IRLP link so you'll be able to talk back and forth with us. So please, I'm looking forward to that, John. Once again, this is AC2GS. This is the Limark Technical Net, established in 1982 by Dick K2RIW, who is silent key this morning. Became a silent key. So if anyone would like to say anything tonight on that subject, or any subject, I guess, please feel free. Give me your first name and your call sign.
RMD Mobile, first name is Russell, Romeo Uniform, Sierra Sierra, Echo Lima Lima.
Yes, Russell, what would you like to say tonight?
Not a question, it is more of a comment, but it is a tech comment. And my very first coax was a 100-foot length of RG8X, which I bought on Amazon. It was horrifically bad. It was very rigid. The outer shield was steel mesh, believe it or not. Within a month, right at the PL259, the outer shield was already unraveling. And I used that coax on 10 meters, which my 10-meter antenna I don't really use too much, so I didn't really think too much of it. But now that sporadic east season is coming back, I started using it more often. And the DSB 10-meter net meets on Tuesdays, and their station's as close as only like 5-7 miles away, and they could barely hear me. The signals I was receiving was always very low, and I just attributed it to, like, well, 10-meter ground wave really isn't as good as you know, the lower band. And everyone I talked to was the signal was just horrible, both on receive and transmitting. And let me drop. So I went back onto 10 meters earlier today, and my SWR skyrocketed to like a 10 to 1. So I finally had enough of it. I unscrewed it, and I took my RG213 off my 6-meter antenna, put it on my 10-meter antenna. And wouldn't you know, all of the signals were so much stronger. I made one contact. They heard me no problem. And my SWR was the same. And I just wanted to comment that the coax that you buy on Amazon, I can only imagine how lossy that coax was, both on transmit and receive. So it was a small little discovery that I made today. And you know what? I always knew that it was bad coax. I just never connected the dots, and I was kind of smacking myself in the head for why I continued to use it. So that problem has been rectified. I'll send it back to you.
Okay, Russell, I'm glad everything worked out in the end. It's not an inherent flaw with RG8X. RG8X is a little bit more lossy than most, than say RG8 or
LMR 400 or the other, thicker coaxial cables. But, you know, not all coaxial cables are the same. Different manufacturers have different specs. Some are better than others. Some are terrible. Back in the bad old days, I used to see people having these coaxial cables from Radio Shack. Again, it's not anything against particularly Radio Shack, because sometimes whoever they bought their coax from was good. But there were times that I saw some Radio Shack coax where there were very few pieces of wire doing the job of an outer shield. That thing probably ran like a sieve. So there, you know, not all RG8Xs are created equal. So, you know, if you feel that your transmission line is not exactly what it should be, you're always best to bite the bullet and buy some good, well-known name brand. Amazon is okay, but, you know, it depends on who you're buying through Amazon. Amazon's just the middleman. So if you're buying some LMR 400 or something from Amazon, it's okay. But if you're buying no brand RG8X, you're playing Russian roulette with your transmitter. But I'm glad in the end it ended well for you, Russell.
Thanks a lot. And RG8X on my other antennas for 80, 40, 20 meters. Now that RG8X, I bought the gigabyte shot power. That coax performs wonderfully. Size detected to a CSU sensor and part of the thing. To see if other things that I trouble here in the area was much better off. So when that falls down the tech, and I'm going to look to repeater any minute now, then I'll be within the range of the Western repeater in about 15 minutes. So I'll be on the site monitoring, and thank you much for holding it down. Just getting to our
Okay, Russell, that's great to hear. Well, DX Engineering is a well-known, respected amateur radio company. So they're not going to really give you a broad range of products that range from decent to garbage. Like Amazon really doesn't have any kind of vested interest in giving you good quality, per se. They'll give you whatever you want to buy from them. So if you stick usually to places like HRO or DX Engineering or even Gigaparts on a good day, you end up getting decent quality equipment. I like DX Engineering a great deal. You can call them up and you can ask them all kinds of technical questions. And if they have that stuff in stock, it gets shipped out that night. You don't even have to wait until the following day. So for people who have to have immediate gratification, that's a very nice feature that DX Engineering has. So I'm glad that the other RGX worked the way it was supposed to. It's sort of a shame that Amazon doesn't really have quality control. They have those reviews, but people game reviews all the time. So good luck with that, Russell, and if you get a better connection in 15 minutes and have something you want to share with us, feel free.
KP2, may I have a suggestion?
Yeah, sure, please.
Name here is Gabe. I have a suggestion regarding the coax cable the gentleman is using there. You might want to try a brand called Veriflex from Davis RF. I believe it's Clear Signal Products, the Wireman, formerly the Wireman. I think it's called Clear Signal Products, carries a particular brand. And it's not so expensive, but it's an excellent quality coax cable. It has a polyethylene outer jacket. Nice heavy gauge, well, heavy enough for, you know, for the prices you're paying. You know, it has a nice heavy braid inside it, nice, so it's well shielded. I think it's 98% shield, 100% shield, something like that. But it's really high grade stuff. The center conductor is stranded. I think it's 10 gauge stranded copper. You know, strands equals 10 gauge. The benefit to that is that it's easier to install because it's not as rigid as the hard 9 gauge copper center conductor.
Well, thanks, Gabe. Yeah, when you make the central conductor from stranded wire. You improve the flexibility, you diminish the, you increase the amount of attenuation loss, though. In other words, for a given frequency for 100 feet, there'll be a slight payment that you have to make in the amount of decibels of attenuation that a stranded central line will give you as opposed to a solid one. It sort of depends upon what's important to you. If you need a more flexible transmission line, especially if that makes a lot of sense for, say, a connection between your mast and a rotator, or jumper cables in your shack where you gotta bend them and twist them and turn them. Usually the long length of coaxial cable that runs directly from the feed point to your shack, you can easily get away with the non-flexible, non-stranded. But, you know, they both do excellent work, and I'm familiar with the wire man. I bought some other things from him. I never really purchased any of his coaxial cables. You mentioned it's very flexible. There are other off-label brands that are high quality. You just have to find someone to vouch for their quality. You know, when you get something that's completely no name, but you can't figure out who the hell made it, that's where you're really asking for trouble.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, by the way, this is a stranded, as you know, stranded coax cable, but for HF, it's excellent for HF. I haven't used it on VHF and above, but for HF, it shouldn't be a problem. It's like a 100-foot run, no problem at all. It'll work fine. The most important thing also for this coax is it has a polyethylene jacket, so moisture won't go inside it. And, I've noticed if you can get a hold of the Radio Shack PL259 connectors, I noticed that those connectors go on that coaxial cable very tightly, as opposed to other brands. I noticed there's a difference between how they go onto certain coax cables, because obviously the diameter of certain coax cables are smaller and larger. Even though it's RG8, it doesn't really matter. Each, like you say, each company is a little bit different. But for HF, this Doriflex coax cable is excellent.
Okay, very good, Gabe. I hope Russell was listening in while we were having that conversation. You know, I just settled on LMR 400. It's a very popular brand. It's not the cheapest, but it's incredibly consistent, and I haven't had too many problems with it. I've had problems with connectors, but no real problems with coaxes. And, yeah, some connectors work better with some brands than others. Radio Shack is somewhat problematic because they went through bankruptcy, and although their inventory is still being sold at places, I get the sense that the inventory is not well controlled. So it might be a little bit difficult to find those PL259s. I don't know. I haven't really looked.
TRG with a comment?
Yes, TRG.
You know, my own personal opinion, being in RF and doing with a lot of power for the last 40 years, the one I always fall back on is the RG213U, because the U is it makes it rated better for being outside. The jacket is impervious to the ultraviolet rays. It's 0.5 gauge center conductor, and you get the mil-spec ones from Beldine, which are really good. And I also tend to always gravitate towards the Amphenol connectors. They're not the cheapest around, but I've never had any problems with any units that I've been in my life for these as a technician. And now that I'm doing them, you know, I use them on all my ham gear. Although I'm new, I'm not RF by any stretch of the imagination. So, you know, just a word of advice. You can get the Amphenol connectors usually from DigiKey, or Newmark, Newark, you know, companies like that. Like I said, they're not the cheapest, but I've never had any problems with them, and I've done a lot of installs on the outside, stuff like that. KD2TRG, back to that.
Okay, thanks a lot, Bob. I appreciate that suggestion. LMR has a kind of variable version with a more durable outer shell. I think they call it Variflex. You know, Variflex, I think is what they call it. But yeah, I agree with you. The Amphenol, if you want high quality connectors, Amphenol is certainly a great place to buy them. You pretty much will pay top dollar because they are high quality, and unfortunately, except for rare occasions, you tend to get what you pay for. So thanks, Bob. I agree with your assessment of Amphenol and 213s, both you and standard 213s are incredibly popular with amateur radio operators.
Interesting.
A quick Amazon comment.
Okay, Wesley, did you want to say something about this?
I'll let the gentleman to make a comment. I have a science subject.
Okay, Bob, you wanted to say something.
Yes, going back to the Amazon, my experience with Amazon is just a little thing. It seems that when you look at Amazon for buying radio equipment, their prices are often a little higher than all the places like HRO or DX Engineering, and we're surprised because often they have the best prices, but it's a little higher on Amazon. And like you say, the other issues you said about Amazon, the only good thing I would say about getting something on Amazon, sometimes you might want that 30-day return policy, which I don't think any ham radio stores give you that. So that's just my 2 cents on Amazon and ham radio equipment. Back to that, this is KD2NBB.
Well, I would agree with you, Bob. The thing, though, with Amazon is not all their stuff comes from reputable places. The stuff that comes from reputable places, like I'm sure that Gigaparts sells through Amazon and some of the other places sell through Amazon. They don't give you any particular deal, so you end up paying either the same or a couple of bucks more. The beauty and the pain in Amazon is they have no real quality control issues. So along with the HROs or the Gigaparts distributors, you're going to get some guy in a shack in Sichuan, China, who found a couple of PL-259s in the bottom of a drum someplace, and he's now going to sell it through Amazon. And for all we know, they could be metric screws, or they could be 75-ohm impedances, or some other variation that's useless for us. But, you know, they don't know, and they don't care. So that I think, is the issue that Russell was kind of discussing, that, you know, sometimes you play a little Russian roulette when you go to Amazon. If you stick with the well-known distributors, you don't get any kind of financial benefit, except, of course, that replacement thing. That's a nice little added bonus. It depends upon how lucky you feel, I guess.
Yes, Amazon, like I said, the prices are actually usually a bit higher. But I will tell one quick story. I now have a Chameleon F-Loop 2.0, you know, that was a small mag loop. And when I was going to shopping for it, I wasn't sure I wanted to try it out and see how well it worked in my apartment. Well, it turns out it works terribly in my apartment, and it turns out I'm glad I have it anyway. But at the time, I was thinking, well, if it doesn't work well in my apartment, even if the antenna's fine, I might want to return it. I actually talked to the guy at Chameleon, and he even suggested, well, you know, you could buy it on Amazon. They have the 30-day return policy. So I can see that situation possibly being an advantage. It's like about the only advantage for buying ham radio equipment on Amazon. Then it turned out the Chameleon shortly after that had some kind of special with them. As it turned out, Amazon returns, and I got it through Chameleon at 30% off, so I paid $350 instead of $500. And there were a couple defects, but there was no problem. He mailed me free parts, and they got all fixed up. So that's my little story about Amazon. Back to you, Roy. This is KD2NBB.
Okay, Very good, Bob. I like Amazon. It's like anything. You have to know how to use tools, and Amazon to me is a tool. You have to figure out how much of the reviews are BS, the companies, whether they're legit or not legit, and make intelligent decisions. I mean, yes, ultimately you could just complain to Amazon, and for some strange reason, they're very lax with return policies and such, and that's a good thing. But, you know, they're not always the cheapest thing. I never quite understood amateur radio operators. Usually it's kind of new guys who try and get most of their equipment through Amazon, I guess because that's what they're used to doing for consumer goods, you know, radios and microwave ovens and things like that. So they just said, yeah, sure, we'll just look it up on Amazon and buy it from them. You know, sometimes it's a nice thing to go through the retailers. You get to actually talk to them. You get to interact with them, whereas on Amazon, there's really no one to talk to. They hide their telephone numbers like it was a trade secret. But I'm glad to hear that you got 30% off. You know, there's always sales that are popping up. You have to be a smart shopper, even with amateur radio gear.
KD2RZ Mobile returning.
Oh, okay, Russell. Got anything to say?
No, everyone's comments was pretty much spot on. And, you know, fortunately for me, early on in my studies, there was a YouTube channel that I followed. The channel Ham Radio Concepts. It's run by KJ41CI. I'm a proponent of Gigaparts, and that's how I discovered Gigaparts. So pretty much from day one, I purchased, not really through Amazon, I purchased, you know, my first radio through Gigaparts, a lot of accessories and cables, and I'm a proponent of Gigaparts. Everything that they sell is very, very good. And so now I have pretty much 100 feet of RG8X that I don't know what to do with. I'm probably using it to grab it and practice. That's something I've never done before. It's a little work on, and who knows, maybe I'll take a link to that coax and I'll make some antenna out of it. And so looking at that coax last night closely, there's no labeling on the outer jacket, no labeling at all. So you know what, you're probably right, it probably was found in the drum somewhere in China. So now what are you gonna do? Change your
Very good, Russell. Yeah, I think the only thing that you should really use that for is as an object lesson of coax cables. They're not all created equal. I don't think I would use it. You could use it to show people or train people how to put connectors on, as long as you don't use the connectors on that cable. But otherwise, I wouldn't make anything electrical out of something that has such poor quality. I mean, who knows? Yeah, I don't know if the shielding is awful or the dielectric is off somehow or the center is off somehow. And see, that's one of those things. If you had a vector network analyzer, you could run all kinds of curiously interesting experiments where basically you pulse a signal from the front to an either open connection or 50 ohm connection or shorted connection, and you look to see the number of impedance changes as it bangs around that old very badly made coaxial cable. Okay, Russell, safe driving, and we'll be here next Sunday if you want to pop in and tell us something or ask something. Wesley, you wanted to ask a question, hopefully not too deep a question, because, you know, soon it's going to be time for Paul's space report.
Humoristically, if I ask the question, it will take the whole time that is led to the space report. It's a science question. Hypothetically, if all matter and energy could be removed from universe, what would be left? What is space made of?
Well, it sort of depends upon what you believe in. Most physicists, hopefully, who follow quantum field theory, would say that space-time is filled up with a bunch of fields. They don't necessarily have to be excited. So the things that we see as mass and energy are excitations of those fields. But nevertheless, empty space is not truly empty. They manifest fields, and because quantum mechanics suggests that there's no such thing as zero, there are fluctuations in the quantum field even when there is no completely apparent energy or mass in that space-time.
You might know the guy, Scott Gordon, MD, orthopedic surgery, and master. He was in New York Medical College. The guy made a lot of noise. Let me drop. So he was interested with more than just medical field, and he, similar to you, he was deeply going into physics. He created a theory of everything, which had two postulates, which was Gordon omnipresent, that, and God entities. But besides that, he was also criticized by professional physicists in theoretical fields of it. Some answer that I was able to read was that Mr. Gordon was empty-headed, fool with zero knowledge in physics. Not going to that, and not going to I'm just wondering, did you ever hear about this guy in Turkey?
No, Wesley, I never heard of him. He got some links to interesting articles. You know my email address. I'm kind of in between attitudes. I understand, and John, that we mentioned recently, Kyle and Keith, for about 3-4 years, unfortunately, had this interesting theory that if a person was not being paid to professionally work in that field for at least 3 years, John didn't give a damn what his opinion on the subject was. He was unqualified. And I understand that. Unfortunately, that would kind of rip a complete hole in space-time for me, because I don't have any professional standing either in physics or, for that matter, electrical engineering. So I kind of veer into the other extreme, saying that if you have enough determination and good source materials, you don't necessarily need to be a professional in the field. But most professionals tend not to feel that way. Most physicists will disparage a physician. Physicians will probably disparage physicists if they start to give medical advice. I know when Linus Pauling, who was a brilliant, charming chemist, started to hawk vitamins. With a guy whose credentials were a doctorate of medicine instead of a PhD in physics.
Yeah, well, I must agree with you. The only thing is that there is a double format, or may I may not understand it. And now we're talking about they have the same discussion as I had with John, sort of I'm trying to oppose. So yes, I do agree with you. A person who is into it could be as good as the professor who is, or the person who is in that field with job. But going to the question, how about if we say that space-time is created by the process of energy and matter as shown in quantum relativity? And if you take away the matter and energy, you also take away a space-time. So what is left in holistic state of conservation of root change function? Basically the archetype of all functions. The universe is not only defined by the space, by the time or space or matter and energy in it, and any more than the coffee or tea in a mug defines the mug. And to exist.
Someone needs a sleeping pill. Anyway, Wesley, again, this is highly theoretical, but usually I think the concept is that space-time is there whether there is matter or energy. Matter and energy will warp space-time, but it does not define space-time. Theoretically have a bunch of space with no energy going through it or any matter going through it, and it's still space-time. So I'm not quite sure if I agree with the concept that matter produces space-time. I think they're different things. They interact with each other, certainly, but they're different things.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your response, and I'm going to go to Dr. Scott Garden, a classical question. Why is the speed of light not 10 miles per hour more or 20 miles per hour less? And that question is for the entertainment.
Okay, let me see. Yeah, I got it. Anyway, the thing to think about as far as why does light travel at the speed of light in a vacuum is not exactly completely related to solely light. It's actually a limitation of space-time itself. Things cannot travel through space-time at any speed faster than the speed of light. Information can't travel across space-time any faster than the speed of light. So things that don't have any inertial mass, like light or gravitational waves, travel at the speed of light because that's the limitation. It's, again, not quite a limitation of these forces, but a limitation upon space-time itself for anything to traverse its dimension. So that's the limitation that we call the speed of light in a vacuum, is the causality rate in space-time itself.
Yeah, but the question was more deep into it. Why speed of light is not 10 miles more or 10 miles less per hour?
Okay, unfortunately, I do not have a good reason why causality is locked down at the rate that it is. I do not think that quantum field theory shows that. That's one of the many problems with quantum mechanics, is there's a whole bunch of constants that just exist for no apparent reason. And they seem to us to be arbitrary. You cannot calculate them from simpler principles. So I'm assuming that the speed of light in the vacuum, unfortunately, is one of those inherent constants in the way that the universe tends to run. Now, it might be a consistent constant,